Welcome to Inflection Point, conversations with women changing the status quo. I'm Lauren Schiller. Today on Inflection Point...
A stereotype is like you take a cardboard box and you put it over somebody's head and you slap a label on it, so all you see is the label.
We talk with Lara Mandel of the Mosaic Project. Conflict resolution, diversity, inclusion. The buzzwords are enough to make a world-weary worker roll their eyes. Yet these are critical elements to achieving a just and peaceful society. Where to start? Lara Mandel, founder of the Mosaic Project, says it all starts with the children. Welcome, Lara.
Thank you.
Tell us what the Mosaic Project is.
The Mosaic Project is a 501c3 nonprofit, and I'm very biased, but I do think it is one of the greatest organizations in the world. And we're getting at some of the heart of some of the problems that have been making the news a lot lately. Our main program is an outdoor school that brings together students from very, very different backgrounds. So we bring together 3 fourth or fifth grade classes. Students come with their whole class and their teacher. And they come to an outdoor school, a beautiful camp setting. We have a place we rent now in Napa, owned by the Lighthouse School for the Blind. It's called the Enchanted Hills Camp, and they're with us in the Enchanted Hills for 4 nights and 5 days. And we bring 3 classes together that come from very different communities. So we'll have one class come from a lower-income school, and usually mostly homogenous in terms of the race, ethnic background, culture of the students. We'll bring them together with one school that's more diverse, and then with another school from a more upper-income community, sometimes an independent school, sometimes public, where the students are primarily white. And we mix 3, sometimes 4, depending on class size, of these classes together. And the students are all mixed in their cabins and what we call their sharing groups. And we are together for 4 nights and 5 days addressing issues of difference and building community. And more specifically, we are appreciating differences, recognizing prejudice, stereotyping, and discrimination. We are looking at communication and nonviolent conflict resolution, teamwork and cooperation, and respect for self and others. And everything is done through experiential education.
And what is that?
Experiential education, you are learning by doing. And I strongly believe when it comes to these issues, it's not enough to read about it or study about it, that you have to live it. And that's at the core of experiential education. So part of it means that we're just coming together and living together. But then the curriculum itself is all games, activities that inspire thought and activism around these issues. Also, stories and songs. We write songs for everything that we teach. We have a CD. I wrote the songs originally with our resident rock star, Brett Denon, who we produced his first CD, but he's gone on to become quite famous and successful and still on our board of directors and does a concert with us every year. And since then, we've worked with many other musicians as well who also write songs. And we just, you know, life's a musical up there.
Are you a musician yourself?
I'm a wannabe.
You're a songwriter.
I write songs, but I need help. I need help with those too.
And why that age group? Why 3rd through 5th grade?
4th and 5th grade. We actually work with literally all ages in our in-school programs and our youth leadership program, which I'll also talk about, and our consulting project. We choose 4th and 5th grade for the outdoor school because that's the youngest we can go and take them away from school for a week. The research shows that people start to exhibit prejudice between 2.5 and 8 years old. And some research out there is now saying even earlier. I don't believe that it makes sense to wait to address these issues. And yet most organizations addressing these issues in such an intense level, bringing people together, start when students are in high school or college or even later. We're the only organization that we know of our kind doing this kind of work, bringing people together in such a way with this age group. So 4th and 5th grade is as young as we can go and get them away from school. And it is a really prime age where students are really understanding that other people have different perspectives and see the world differently than they do. So it's a prime time to really work on empathy.
And for many of them, I'm sure this is their first time away from home for that length of time.
For most of them, it is. And we like it that way because even if we were doing nothing but hanging out and playing, it would still be this incredible life-changing experience being away from home like that for the first time. But we do our best to make it, for many of them, the best week of their lives. And that is the way that research in contact theory says that you have to address issues of prejudice, that it isn't enough just to bring people together, but that people have to be brought together for prolonged periods of time, be working on common goals, be addressing the issues head on, and have role models of diverse backgrounds, modeling that it's okay to, it's great to have friendships across lines of difference. And then, of course, it doesn't hurt to supply some communication and conflict resolution skills along with that. So that's what the research out there says. We've been doing it that way all along. And I just have always believed in the power of residential education, getting students, adults, doesn't matter who, away from their usual setting, into the beautiful outdoors, living together in community. There's a magic that happens there that just can't be replicated in a classroom, in school, in any other way.
Well, I have to say, full disclosure, that both of my children went through the Mosaic Project programs, and they did come home singing many of the songs.
Excellent. Hopefully so you're thanking me for that, because they do stick in the brain, I know.
So why, you mentioned earlier that particularly now we need this. Why do you say that?
Oh, I don't say particularly now we need this. I think we have needed it all along.
Okay.
That's that. I think that... it's making there's a lot in the news right now saying that, well, given the issues in the world today, I think these problems are ancient problems. I just think they're getting a lot of attention right now. And therefore, this is a prime time to call attention to our work and hopefully get more people on board understanding what we do. Because I do believe that we have not the only solution, but we have a solution for what people are talking about out there in terms of the violence and discrimination and prejudice, hatred in the world and difficulty that we have as humans interacting with people different from us.
Do you wish that you could interject yourself into some of these conversations and offer up some tools?
Constantly, and I do sometimes. Yeah.
What's an example of that? How do you do that?
Any sort of time like now is a great opportunity to talk about our work. And we definitely need to be out there doing more PR and outreach like this. And talking about how the fact that we do have some solutions.
What are some examples of the ways that you work with the college students or in a corporation? Are they the same approaches? Or
same approaches with the fourth and fifth graders. We are all human. We are all big kids.
So give us
and
give
in
us...
a lot of ways, the fourth and fifth graders are a lot. You learn a lot more quickly than us older folks.
Entrenched. Well, what's an example of what you would do if you went into a corporation?
Okay. Which is an example of what we do with everything. To explain that, I'm going to start off by just giving some of the theory behind our work. We really come at everything from the framework of the pyramid of violence and the pyramid of peace. Right. So the idea is that we believe that segregation, separation is the foundation to violence, that from separation, segregation comes ignorance and fear. And that leads to prejudice, which leads to discrimination, which leads to violence, which can lead to war and genocide. And so what we're trying to do at the Mosaic Project is dismantle that pyramid, which is, of course, self-perpetuating because the discrimination, the violence leads to further segregation. So we're trying to dismantle that, but not just dismantle it, transform it into what we call the pyramid of peace. And the idea is that it follows that if segregation leads to violence, that connection leads to peace. And I feel like I've seen that on so many different levels. So we start with connection leading to respect, and we break that down as respect, look again, not just making a snap judgment, understanding that the other people have different perspectives, which helps us to empathize. And then from there, we build to assertive communication, and assertive conflict resolution is how we describe those peacemaking tools leading to peace. So in every workshop that we do, whether it's the week-long outdoor school, whether it's an hour and a half parent training, whether it's a four-hour workshop at a corporation, we're building, dismantling that pyramid of violence and building up that pyramid of peace. So we start just with building connection. And then from there, we work on respect. From there, we work on different perspectives and empathy. And then we build to a sort of communication and conflict resolution. So for example, if you're in a corporation and it's a very siloed environment, you may be sitting right next to your colleague in the next cubicle, but if you don't actually know them and have real conversations with them, you're not connected. And that leads to all sorts of misunderstandings and I think prejudice and maybe not physical violence, although it could, but it can lead to a really unhealthy, unpleasant work atmosphere, which isn't effective or productive or great for anybody.
So at the most basic level, are you facilitating conversations?
Yeah, a little more interesting than that. So yeah. For example, we often walk into rooms where people are forced to be there when we're doing a professional development training, where people don't really, you know, are not really that excited about having to be there. And this activity helps us win them over. They can't help themselves. So simple. We just call it Cecil.
Cecil.
Mm-hmm. Our youth leaders discovered that the word Cecil in a game of Boulder Dash, they discovered that the word Cecil, S-E-S-S-L-E, means to mix it up frequently. And so we call it that, and we just dance around. We play some good music. People have to dance. They have to get out of their comfort zone and dance. And then find a partner, stand back to back, and then we'll give prompts of things to talk about. And we can start off a little bit lighter, and then we go a little bit deeper. And, you know, they'll start off resistant, especially adults not wanting to dance. Can't help themselves.
I can only imagine.
And they warm up. They just warm up. They do.
As a business, as a nonprofit, how are you finding the ability to make this something that's sustainable?
Mm-hmm. Like any nonprofit, I'm like, ah. So that's one of the reasons we do corporate training.
Because
it helps us raise money. Yeah. So about 36% of our income comes from the program fees. We charge on a sliding scale for our schools and for our organizations. And some of our lower income schools can't pay anything. And it's gotten worse in that. So, you know, 36%. We're working with people of all different income levels, and we do the sliding scale. The rest of our funding comes from individual donations and grants and foundations. So fundraising is always, always, always a challenge. We're always doing it. We always will be doing it. However, I have a dream that our corporate trainings will get to the point where they are providing more income to fund our youth programs. I feel like it's a win-win situation. I think they get some world-class trainings that are so much more fun and interesting and dynamic than often happens in the workplace. And at the same time, they're supporting great work being done in the community. And I would rather spend my time raising money doing actual work that makes a difference than writing a grant application.
What has most surprised you in your work in doing this?
Many things. I don't know if it's surprising or just it's like confirming in such a way that it's surprising. Two things. One is how we as adults do need that we are just big kids and we do need exactly what the kids need. And just seeing that. I think when we first started doing the corporate trainings, I thought we can make a difference, but I was not aware of how huge the impact could be because I think I had my own prejudice. I didn't expect people to be as open for what we're doing. So, you know, I guess this did surprise me. To me, it felt like people were hungry for it. People are not used to having real conversations, honest conversations with each other and connecting on a deeper level. And as soon as you open up that opportunity, to me, it felt like people were hungry for it. And I think that was surprising to see the way that I think we just tap into something. You know, we could walk into a training where these adults would be resistant, and after about 45 minutes, they would be crying and revealing things that you never thought would cry in a professional training. Be crying and revealing things that you just wouldn't expect. So I think that isn't surprising as that is needed. I think what was surprising is how easy it is to reach that level where people are acknowledging that they're starved for it.
Well, Laura, what in your personal history has made you interested in this?
Yeah. I used to trace it back to just when I was 15, which is when I first got the seeds of the idea for this. But really, I think that the seeds were planted when I was more around 9 fourth grade myself, which isn't surprising, I guess, in some ways. I grew up in Los Angeles, and forced busing was an issue when I was in the LA area. And around that time, the first magnet school in Los Angeles began, LA Center for Rich Studies. And the idea was that it was supposed to have this special program. You know, there's all sorts of performing arts magnets and science magnets and all that. This was a magnet that was supposed to have an enriched program to attract people from different backgrounds. Like, it was very clear that this was building a diverse community. And I went there the very first year with my older sister, fourth grade and sixth grade.
And what year was this?
God, don't ask me that. I have to count. It was the late 70s, early 80s. Okay. Yeah, late 70s. And I was very aware of, I wouldn't have called it activism then. I don't know if I had that word in my vocabulary. But when I think about it now, that I was very aware that that was activism. I was very aware that my family was making this kind of political choice to build this community. And that it was sort of this statement against the racism that we were hearing around us. So I was very aware of that. And it was very exciting to be part at 9 years old. I remember the principal, new principal, leaning down and shaking my hand and how that felt of like, I'm going to be part of building this incredible community. It was very exciting. So that was probably the root of it. I stayed at that school through 11th grade. And we didn't talk about the issues head on. Here, that was the purpose it was created. But we didn't talk about race and gender and class and culture in an open way. I wanted to, you know, I was in the same school for a long time. I wanted to graduate early. But I didn't understand that I had to have enough units that I couldn't just, you know, leave because I had taken certain classes. And then the opportunity came up to go to this camp for 4 nights and 5 days in the summer. And I could get credit that could go towards my leaving school early. So I went. Turned out to be a program that brought students from all different backgrounds in LA together to intentionally talk about racism, sexism, and homophobia. They actually broke it up in those three distinct categories. And it was mind-blowing. Has definitely shaped who I am. So when people say, you can't do anything in just 4 nights and 5 days, I'm an example of that. Blew my mind. And I stayed involved with that program into college. And it also showed me that there were things that I didn't like about it. And one of the things that was clear of like, wow, I'm 15 and I go to this intentionally different school, intentionally diverse school, and we don't talk about these issues. Here I am for the first time talking outside, out of my Jewish family or out of my Hebrew school. My German grandparents got out of Nazi Germany just in time. And, you know, the Holocaust was always a big topic in my family. My grandfather on my mother's side escaped from Russia under hay in a hay wagon. Violence, discrimination, the Holocaust was always a topic, but not in a diverse setting. So here was the first time at 15. So I saw violence break out at the program. I saw kids wanting to get sent home, kids getting sent home. I saw adults who felt to me like they were there first and foremost for themselves rather than to support the children that were in the program. So, you know, there were some things that I was like, okay, when I am older, I want to do this work in a different way, with more love, more imagination, and I want to do it with younger students before the anger and the fear is so deeply entrenched. So that was like the seeds of the idea. Mm-hmm. Then I got to experience environmental science education myself, going to outdoor schools with my biology class and just experiencing the magic of being in the outdoors and how much more can be learned in that kind of setting, the magical transformation that can happen. So, you know, that was a seed planted. And then when I was a student at Stanford, I was invited with a group of 18 students from Stanford Hillel, the Jewish student organization, by the German government to travel to Germany over the summer and meet with ex-Nazis, with German students to meet with ex-Nazis and talk about the Holocaust. And that is pretty much where it was all. The commitment was, I think, really was solidified. I think I understood these issues on a fairly deep level and intellectual level by this time, but this just did something on my gut level of, oh, a little prejudiced thought
really can lead to horrific, horrific, horrific violence.
Well, did anything that you that any of the people that you met with that were these ex-Nazis, did anything that they said to you resonate with you then, stick with you today?
Yeah. I think part of what stuck is the students that we were with who were so committed to making sure that something like that didn't happen again, not feeling guilty but feeling responsible. So that was super powerful and inspiring. With the ex-Nazis, it was a lot of, well, we did what we had to do. You don't understand. It was the times. We didn't have a choice that what we had to do for ourselves and our families. And there was a lot of requests for forgiveness, which I just felt like that's not my place. That's not why I'm here. That idea felt foreign to me. Like, that's not my place to do that. I think that's, you know, between you and you. But it was certainly interesting to hear those stories and in some cases denial. I remember being in certain towns where people were like, well, we didn't really know what was happening behind those fences. And the fences are right there in the town. It's like, yes, it'd be some work to not know what was happening. But one of the moments that I think really stands out for me is when we were meeting with young soldiers that were just talking about their experiences. And they started talking about the Turks in Germany and using some of the same language that could have been applied to Jews in the 30s and 40s. And we pointed that out. And the response was, oh, no, you don't understand. These people are so different from us and the culture is so different from us. And that was really a powerful moment for me. It's like, oh, yeah, you're not seeing the connection. And a lot of people don't see the connection. And this is how those little prejudiced thoughts can turn into these horrific, horrific things.
Are there ways that our listeners can get involved in the Mosaic Project?
Absolutely. Of course, you can go to www.mosaicproject.org. And of course, if you're a teacher, you can begin a conversation about bringing your school up to the outdoor school. If you are a young person, 15 to 23, you can become a youth leader. You can become a facilitator on our staff. There's all sorts of ways to volunteer and get involved. Yeah.
What's the best advice, Laura, about empathy that you've ever gotten?
It's the children. Most of those kinds of best advice, best lessons I've gotten from the children that we teach. This is going to be about stereotyping, but it is all about empathy. So stick with me for just a moment. I know I'm not good at a short story. We were explaining stereotyping to the students, and one of the students said, stereotype is like you take a cardboard box and you put it over somebody's head and you slap a label on it. So all you see is the label. And now that's how we teach it. In all of our trainings, we will put a cardboard box over somebody's head and slap the label geek or bully. Bully is a stereotype. If you're actually labeling somebody a bully, you can't empathize with them. They're not a person to you. So you could put bully, you could put thug, you could put geek, whatever it is, we'll slap that label on the box. And then you look at that person in front of you and all you see is a box. They're not a person, they're a box with a label on them. And when somebody is dehumanized to you and all they are is a label, then you cannot empathize with them. You cannot put yourself in their shoes because they're not an actual person to you. So that a lot of what empathy is it's taking that box off somebody's head, respecting, looking again, so that you can actually really think about, feel what it would be like to be that other person. I believe that if we're actually empathizing, that it is not possible to treat somebody violently. I think we might hurt somebody by accident. We can do it unintentionally. But I think that if we're truly empathizing, it is not possible to hurt somebody intentionally. So I do think that empathy is totally key. I know it's a big buzzword right now. It is. We talk about three keys to peace at the Mosaic Project: listening, empathy, and assertiveness. And this idea of assertiveness, not being passive, not being aggressive, being assertive, being strong without being mean, being respectful of yourself and the other people around you. And I believe that is the way of a peacemaker. Empathy is a key to peace. And I believe listening and assertiveness are too. And that idea of the cardboard box from a fourth grader, fifth grader, that's how I came to best understand what gets in the way of it.
Laura, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you. My pleasure.
That was Laura Mendel, the founder of the Mosaic Project. That's our inflection point for today. Is there a woman changing the status quo you'd like to hear from? Let us know at inflectionpointradio.org. And while you're there, I invite you to become a patron of Inflection Point, like Connor Kellicott and Sabrina Moyle, who are helping bring the voices and views of powerful women to the ears of everyone. And you can too at inflectionpointradio.org. Inflection Point is produced at the studios of KALW Radio in San Francisco and delivered to public radio stations nationwide through PRX. Subscribe to our podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Our engineer and producer is Eric Wayne. I'm your host, Lauren Schiller.